Good afternoon, everybody. We'll get started with our second lecture in the BHI colloquium this quarter. It's my pleasure to have Sherry Fuller present today. Sherry is, among other things, a fellow of the American College of Medical Informatics, which is an honorary society for informatics. She was the prime developer of the Global Partners in Public Health Informatics Initiative, which is described in the handout. She was the founding head of the Division of Biomedical and Health Informatics, and currently has really been focused on appropriate use of information technology in low-resource settings, or global public health informatics. In this context, she is co-director of the Center for Public Health Informatics and has appointments in biomedical and health informatics, in the Information School, and in health services, which spans that sort of universe. The theme of her talk today, which was originally an invited keynote at the BioSecure 2009 conference in Taipei, Taiwan, builds on the theme that we started last week of what can we do with all of this information. In other words, we're beginning to accumulate more and more electronic information about healthcare, health measures, health outcomes. How can we aggregate those and leverage those for effective secondary uses? So with that, Sherry.
Thanks, Peter, for that introduction. I'm really delighted to be here, and for the new students to say hello. I happen to have been in Taipei at the point at which you were being oriented to our program, so I didn't get a chance to greet you in person. As Peter said, this talk is based on a talk I gave in Taipei, 2-3 weeks ago? BioSecure 2009, which has been a recurring conference over the last 4 or 5 years, spearheaded by H.C. Chen, who is a researcher and very senior faculty member at the University of Arizona, and who has done some very interesting work around new approaches to biosurveillance and biosecurity. So I really, I had a great time at this meeting. I learned a lot, particularly about what they're doing in that part of the world about H1N1 and other emerging infections. And I think the United States should be paying more attention to what some other parts of the world are doing. At the conference, they were incredibly disease prevention oriented, and I barely got into the auditorium area. Well, I hadn't entered the auditorium before a student had sprayed my hands and missed my hands, in one case sprayed my face, and had checked my temperature. So both days of the conference they were doing that, and also at the airports, screening for high temperatures coming in. Some of the epidemiologists in attendance at this meeting actually taught us how to evade. If you do think you have a temperature and you're getting off in an airplane in China or elsewhere, there are ways to prevent, to bring down your temperature fast. And offline, I'm happy to explain how they told us to do that. Because otherwise, you could very easily end up in a hotel room for a couple of weeks, as happened to some friends of mine, instead of on vacation in China, as they had intended. Okay, so what this talk is about, and Peter's really nice introduction, is about connecting all of these bits and bytes of information that we are now drowning in. And what I tried to do in this talk is look from a historical perspective about where we've been and how some lessons of the past might apply to where we are today. The surveillance issue, according to the World Health Organization, is the cornerstone of public health security. But in many parts of the world, including, unfortunately, in the United States, it is very disconnected from the reality of health care. So you have surveillance systems which sit over here, which monitor public health, population health, community health, and then you have healthcare systems which support individual patient information, and never the two shall meet. And I just had a conversation with a grad student whose committee I am, grad PhD committee I'm serving on, in line just a few minutes ago about this problem and the problem she is facing in doing her research and trying to get clinical information to apply to a population analysis. So prediction is obviously at the heart of systems that we are building, and looking at what we know about trade and trade routes is very much a part of that prediction. So I looked at some yesterday and today kinds of issues around trade and trade routes. The challenges in low resource setting, again, as Peter said, I'm working very much in low resource settings around the world, and I have never yet seen a health department, and I've said this many times, that isn't a low resource setting, whether in the developing world or the developed world, whether Seattle King County or Kitsap County or in Nairobi, Kenya. The whole problem around trade in things, in commodities, in animals, unfortunately in people, and the effect on public health is something that has been termed the Global Express by Dr. Anne-Marie Kimball, who is an emerging infections expert and faculty member here at UW, who I've worked closely with for quite a few years now. And I'll say more about that. The animal-human connection, we know about a number of diseases that are transmitted back and forth between animals and humans, and I don't think enough attention is being paid to that connection. I'll then turn to some building blocks for building systems, and then look at it, at charting a path forward, new approaches to old problems. So history, this probably is not news, but infectious agents have always been around from the beginning of time, or human time. Smallpox was described in ancient Egyptian and Chinese writing. Likewise, malaria, polio have likely existed since very early times. The bubonic plague, which is one of the really scary things that happened, killed probably 20 million people in Europe alone in the 14th century. In the 20th century, the 1918 influenza epidemic, which has taught us a lot about how we should behave in a pandemic such as we are in right now with H1N1, probably killed 50 million people worldwide, including my paternal grandfather and his brother, who were very young men in their early 30s, and who died within 2 days of becoming ill with the in the influenza epidemic of 1918. We're now in the midst of a pandemic, H1N1, which is behaving in ways that are different from the typical seasonal flu. I learned a lot about this, as I said, when I was at the meeting in Taiwan, because we had disease experts from across Southeast Asia and beyond, and they were describing the cause of death in various age groups as a result of H1N1, and it was very interesting how different the cause of death, the predominant causes of death. In Japan, encephalopathy tends to be one of the most common causes of death. But what was common across these countries, including Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, Japan, Taiwan, and China, is that mainland China, is that there was commonality in that it is hitting, as it is in the U.S. and elsewhere, the very young and pregnant women. And that is true in these other countries, although the cause of death is somewhat different from country to country. So that in itself is a really interesting phenomenon, and one that we don't have good ways of looking at data, which, of course, the World Health Organization is trying to do and would like to do, but we don't really have good ways of making those kinds of comparisons and having up-to-date information that could tell us what's going on and why Thailand has much higher death rates than other countries. We have some hints about why that is so. But this was a really good experiment in the context of biosurveillance, in that we had these disease experts attending this meeting, as well as biomedical and health informatics experts. So why are we still the victims of pandemics and unable to predict and control outbreaks? Dr. Anne-Marie, Dr. Kimball wrote a book called Risky Trade, Infectious Disease in the Era of Global Trade, that I think everyone should read. It's a really interesting view of what is going on and what the whole global express, as she called it, the system that connects us across oceans, continents, boundaries, cultures, languages, groups, ethnicities, and trade systems, how all of this interacts to create the kinds of disease pandemics that we're seeing, and the other unexpected health consequences, where we can now travel across the world, and animals can and do travel across the world, both on their own and because they've created poultry, and livestock that are traded across the world, but also, of course, wild birds that move from place to place. The trade routes, this is a really interesting set of maps. The reproduction doesn't do it justice. Were trade routes where there was a lot of research going on cholera epidemics, and I just noticed that there's another cholera set of cholera epidemics happening in sub-Saharan Africa right now. But they were tracing cholera epidemics and looking at trade routes, the shipping trade routes. The trade routes are not so different today. You could overlay a map of some of the shipping trade routes, and they would mimic many of these from the 1800s. The author of this book, The Defense of Europe Against Cholera, Proust, is the brother of the Proust that you may have read in literature courses. Just in case you're curious, they are related. The book is in French, so I had to work on my rusty French. But again, the similarities of the trade routes, and the other interesting thing that came out of that I learned in this book is that you've heard the word clean bill of health used generically. Well, it actually came about in this period, and it was used to indicate that a ship was disease-free and could dock in port and unload passengers and cargo. Of course, as with today, money would exchange hands, and often there could be disease on the ship, but if enough money exchanged hands, it didn't matter that some of the passengers might have cholera or other diseases. So this is one of the vulnerabilities in an age before airplanes, but we have the same kinds of problems today. Another interesting development has to do with the animal-human connection and vector-borne disease spread. I happen to pick dengue because it's of great concern in a lot of parts of the world. Because, as you will see with the red areas, those are areas that have Aedes aegypti, the mosquito that causes or carries dengue. And then the areas that aren't red are areas that have that particular mosquito. And those areas are increasing dramatically with global climate change. The mosquitoes can survive in many more areas than they could previously. So you could predict, as is happening right now, epidemiologists are predicting much more widespread dengue, which can become a very serious disease. Another interesting map or that I found interesting that illustrates some of the problems of mosquito-borne disease in particular is this map of Eritrea. And I don't know how many of you know where Eritrea is, but it's a small country on the Red Sea in the northeast part of Africa, a very small country. I believe it's smaller than the state of New York, which is not the largest state by any stretch in the U.S. Well, Eritrea has this very interesting data about the incidence of clinical malaria, monthly incidence. And essentially what this shows is that this very tiny country has incredibly different incidences of clinical malaria and has peaks and valleys at different times of the year. So the map on the left, the high incident or moderate incidence in the east compared with the incidence in October, and then contrast it with the top, which is a different part of Eritrea. So you end up with this map, which is incredibly complex. And this is only one small country. This is not a large country. This is not trying to figure out how to deal with malaria across the world. So one of the quotes that is very relevant, and again, going back in history, 1937, malaria in Europe, Hackett said, everything about malaria is so molded by local conditions that it becomes a thousand epidemiological puzzles. Like chess, it is played with a few pieces, but capable of an infinite variety of situations. So I guess the footnote to all of this, so hey, you have unlimited data for every country in the world at a very detailed level. So what are you going to do with something as complicated as malaria? Malaria, which causes so many deaths around the world and so much suffering. So a lot of people, including myself, think that we haven't been doing enough about so-called zoonotic diseases, those caused by bacteria, viruses, parasites, or other unconventional agents that are transmissible between humans and animals. And I think there needs to be a lot more attention paid. And fortunately, the Institute of Medicine, which tends to be the place in the United States where work is identified that needs to be done and then funding follows, did a report. Just it was released the day before I spoke in Taipei, and it's called Sustaining Global Surveillance and Response to Emerging Zoonotic Diseases. It's a really good report. It's short, but it is very much about trying to establish a global zoonotic disease surveillance system to better integrate human and animal sectors. Dr. Kimball, who I mentioned earlier, was a participant in this working on this report. It's an area that she has been very concerned about for many years. So I think there's a beginning of recognition, but if we build yet another system, zoonotic disease system, that doesn't talk to all of the human surveillance systems, that doesn't talk to the other kinds of data out there and information, what have we gained is the bottom line question. So some of you probably know I started life as a librarian. I guess one never becomes a not librarian. Once you've been a librarian, you remain a librarian. But I've gone on to do other things in addition. But what I always come back to is a building block that I think is absolutely critical to all health information systems and is very often not well thought about, and that is a classification and being able to classify things, disease, animals that carry disease, and so forth, in very unambiguous terms. So as one of the building blocks that I propose for building systems, health information systems that actually work across boundaries, borders, regions, diseases, is decent classification systems. So to give an example, what do a 17th century mortality table, whose causes of death include fainted in a bath, frighted, and itch. Can you imagine dying of itch? I don't want to think about it. What does that have to do with the assignment of subject headings to books in a library and the separation of machine washable clothes from hand washable clothes? What do those all have in common? Well, obviously, they're all examples of classifications, and they're what, or classification, is what all systems are built upon, systems of all types. William Farr, back in the 1880s, actually made this interesting statement. And again, over 100 years ago, the advantages of a uniform statistical nomenclature, however imperfect, are so obvious that it is surprising no attention has been paid to its enforcement in bills of mortality. Each disease has, in many instances, been denoted by three or four terms, and each term has been applied to as many different diseases. Vague, inconvenient names have been employed, or complications have been registered instead of primary diseases. The nomenclature is of much importance in this department of inquiry, which is actually at what became the World Health Organization International Classification of Diseases. This is part of the history of that part of the organization of the World Health Organization. But the nomenclature is as important in this department as weights and measures in the physical sciences and should be settled without delay. Well, I have news for Dr. Farr. It's far from settled all these many years later. And Jim Cimino, who some of you know, did a paper back in the late 90s about the same topic, International Classification of Diseases, ICD-9, 10, et cetera, and described the problems with it. Inconsistency, lack of concept permanence. That is, you create a term and then that term, it falls into disrepute and is no longer reflected in the vocabulary, but there's no way of linking to what that term became. Disregard for context of where that term occurs. Language translation, so from French to English to Vietnamese. And slow adaptation to new emerging disease terminology. Well, we've all seen this with H1N1. It started out being called what? What was it originally when it first was seen in Mexico? Swine flu. And the determination was made that that was not an appropriate term. So we have H1N1, which doesn't exactly roll off the tongue of the average layperson. It probably sounds even scarier than swine flu. I don't know. But ICD-9, which I did do a look at, what's ICD-9, 10, 11, how would you get to it? Well, you wouldn't, because it is a new disease entity. So this very slow to adapt to new and emerging terminologies is a very important part of the classification problem. So we have all of these problems that I've already described, but the reality is, and I won't say which country this is from, it is not the U.S., but we have some paper-based systems that probably are similar. The reality of most health information systems internationally is that the data collection is done on paper and then transformed into an electronic format with all the attendant risk in transposition of numbers and so forth, with all of the terminology challenges that I've been talking about. And the data is captured by overworked health professionals who often have to make the choice between caring for a very sick person or filling out yet another Ministry of Health form. And guess which choice they make? The same choice that all of us would make. They care for the people. And then at the end of the month, when they have to fill out the forms, they guess, they estimate, they put in numbers that reflect what they think happened during that month. And this is true the world over. And a lot of our disease surveillance, nationally and internationally, is done based on very crude estimates of what is happening on the ground. I want to thank Ramesh Krishnamurthy at the Centers for Disease Control, who works in global health, for this slide. I added to it, bad form design and classification, as we've been talking about, leads to bad data quality, leads to unreliable epidemiological results. Hard to argue with this fact. So this slide is from Carl Brown, program head in health informatics, biomedical informatics at the Rockefeller Foundation, and someone who has provided a lot of support for the global partners work that we've been doing for several years. This is about the global fragmentation And people like to create things. They like to create software, they like to create technology, they like to create systems. But they often do it in a vacuum without paying any attention to what the person across the hall, let alone the person across the world, might have done better, faster, more efficiently, more effectively. And with very little attention or no attention to what the country, the Ministry of Health, is trying to do. So this very large set of initiatives have very little or no interoperability, and it is causing a great crisis in health, healthcare around the world, particularly in developing countries where more money is being spent on these experiments than is being invested in systems that will interoperate and scale. And I just heard another horror story on a Skype call first thing this morning about something that's happening in an area that I'm involved. So this is one of the huge problems. It's great to create a new mobile phone intervention that will allow you to collect data. But what about all the other mobile phone interventions and technologies that have already been created to collect disease data? Wouldn't it be nice to do a survey of what's out there before you create a new one? So to avoid stovepipes, again, this is from Carl Brown, we need ways of communicating and merging data across a number of dimensions, across programs, from census to TB to climate systems, temperatures, and other things. We need across geographies, obviously across the world, across different types of technologies, and across points of care, from individual clinic to community to hospital to national and international. And one of the rules that I like to repeat is that the goal has to be collect data once and use it many times. So if you're collecting patient data, that data should be used for community and population health purposes. De-identified and all of that, but used in a holistic way. We have to move away from these silos of this is a public health system and it does something different than what this patient care system does. And that means for immunizations. If you're doing immunizations, those immunization records should be in the patient record. And I can tell you right this minute, my immunization record is not in my patient record, and I see only physicians at the University of Washington and have my immunizations only at the University of Washington. Know where my immunizations are? They're on my international health card. That's the only place reliably that I can find all of my immunization records. And again, I'm seen here by clinics at the University of Washington only. It's much worse in other systems. Some of the other building blocks, and governance is always one of those things that informatics people kind of don't want to talk about and think isn't their problem. I'm here to tell you that it's a part of the solution, and if you don't leverage and take advantage of what happens at the governance level, whether it's a university governance level or the state or international level, you will lose a lot of opportunities to make a difference. So national governance, one of the big breakthroughs was national quarantine practices. It happened, began to happen internationally in the first half of the 19th century. Horizontal strategies across countries began with an earlier version of the international health regulations, which grew teeth in 2005. So there are actually required regulations now that countries have agreed to. Almost every country in the world signed off on this, which is highly unusual. So those regulations detail what needs to be reported to whom and when, and is a very important part of dealing with this international trade phenomenon and international travel phenomenon. And then the last example, global governance, and again, vertical, that is country strategies, Health Metrics Network, which is led by Sally Stansfield, who is a colleague and a collaborator on a number of things, is leading the development of health information system strategies across countries to build systems that are interoperable and allow you to collect data once and use it many times for community, population, and individual health. So again, you have to look at a framework related to governance and strategies. This is the International Health Regs. They're online in a variety of languages. And this is the Health Metrics Network website, which does some really interesting development work and has identified some strategies for moving forward, which are proving very productive. So emerging technologies, new approaches to old problems. Some of these you probably know about. Some of these, we had a lecture last year by Eric Rasmussen who talked about some of these. And I have talked a little bit about a couple of them. So I'm going to go through them quickly. They're simply examples of where I think we have some traction for building more interoperable, more systems that actually do the kind of cross-border work and improve health, but do it without so much redundancy. The Unified Medical Language System has been under development since it was first articulated as a vision by Dr. Don Lindberg, the director of the National Library of Medicine, in the mid-1800s. It wasn't the 1800s, it was the 1900s, mid-1980s. The UMLS is really misunderstood by a lot of people, and I found an interesting misunderstanding about it in Taipei. It was originally thought that this was a system that was going to tell people what they could call things. So it was going to tell you that you could call the disease H1N1 and you had to use that term. That is not what it is about. It is really an interlingua and being able to link a variety of thesauruses and terms in a way that hopefully, and the goal from the beginning, from the vision that Dr. Lindberg first articulated, is to allow computers to talk to each other in ways that were very precise and very clear. It is a very complex set of tools and technologies. I am extremely excited that we will probably have our first full-time linguistics faculty member, real soon now, in biomedical and health informatics. I think that's been a vision for a very long time. It's a really important area, as I said, about classification and creating systems that can interoperate, semantic interoperability. INSTED. How many of you have heard of INSTED, especially among the new students? Aha, not so many. INSTED's a very interesting organization. I won't go into how they got named. It's an interesting story in itself. But it stands for, in theory at least, it stands for Innovative Support to Emergencies, Diseases, and Disasters. What the INSTED group does, and it was funded, the startup was funded by Google. It is a not-for-profit. They focus on developing flexible open-source software to meet real on-the-ground needs in disaster areas, in emerging, in developing countries, in low-resource settings. And they've developed a number of tools. They're particularly working on the ground in Cambodia and have a research enterprise in Cambodia. One of the developing products is called GeoChat, which supports connections over a variety of media, from web to SMS to email to Twitter. But it also includes the geo part, that is knowing where people are that are a part of a team, being able to report what you see on the ground, to do it in ways that allow you to do it with very simple technology, particularly if there's limited bandwidth, and to be able to coordinate actions. And this has particularly been used in a number of emergency responses, typhoon and other disaster areas, where they've been able to put these on-the-fly geo chat groups together to immediately begin to respond. It's an interesting project in evolving communications. Another problem, or a key problem, is cross-organizational data sharing. And as INSTEAD says, and as Eric Rasmussen, who's the director of INSTEAD, says, it shouldn't be this hard. The data doesn't have to be trapped in silos between among different organizations, different networks, different applications, different formats, different devices. And so the question is, how can you share all of this data and get over the fragmentation? I hate the name of this project, but it's called Mesh4X. And I'm not going to attempt to describe how it works in any detail whatsoever. We're hoping that Ed Jerzynski, who works with Eric and INSTEAD, will be doing a lecture and hopefully talking about this and some of the other INSTEAD projects. But the vision for Mesh4X is that it would provide, again, this is all open source, a versionable repository of data, ontologies, the vocabularies, and executables and configuration capabilities, along with a security authority and a way of linking physical nodes and building this in a way that is very user-friendly to the people on the ground using it. Now, this project is probably the least far along of the various INSTEAD projects, but I think it has some really interesting ramifications if they can pull off what they are trying to do. So with INSTEAD, they have these interesting ways of looking at problems that are very grounded in reality because they're working with a community or with communities on the ground in Cambodia. But they are trying to look at generalizable solutions regardless of what part of the world those applications might be used in. I think that the measure of good technology approaches to the complex problems we're facing really require us to think much more globally before we develop something and figure out how it may fit into other things that are going on. And I think INSTEAD is an example of a group that is trying to do that. Turning to the whole phenomenon of social media, which is not easy to keep up with, and I'm not actually attempting to keep up with. I'm probably the last person on earth who doesn't have my own Facebook page. I simply don't have time to devote to doing one, but we have a family Facebook page, so maybe it's okay. But the idea of using social media for responding to crises, this is actually a publication that explored the various creative ways that social media can be used, both to get public health messages out to the general public, as well as to communicate with each other, a group of epidemiologists being able to create a communications mechanism for dealing with an emerging infection. This happened actually with SARS and EINET, which is Emerging Infections Network that was started here at the University of Washington, was used very successfully during the SARS epidemic because at that point there was not easy ways of communicating without going through governmental bureaucracies. And epidemiologists were simply trying to respond to a very scary phenomenon, SARS, and to do it in a way that avoided some of the bureaucratic tangles. And it turned out EINET was one of the ways that they were able to do that. this story was told to me repeatedly while I was in Taiwan because they were aware of its connection to this university and actually to Anne-Marie Kimball and her work. So I think we have an opportunity with social media and particularly social networking approaches, which Neil Abernathy, one of the BHI faculty, has done work in and has seen some interesting applications in tuberculosis tracking. This is a quick view of the Health Metrics Network Health Information System view. It is a theoretical representation of the architecture of what an architecture might look like for a country. But it's one of the first times that there has been an attempt to build a holistic view that countries could choose to focus on pieces. They don't have to do the whole thing at once, but it gives them a process and a vision of where they might go. And in strengthening health information systems and building interoperable health information systems. There's a lot more on the Health Metrics Network website. So the last building block, I'm almost done, is something that I think there has not been enough attention paid to, and that is the role of universities in this arena, particularly universities in resource-constrained countries. And back in July of 2008, I had the opportunity to lead a week at the Bellagio Conference Center in Italy around planning in public health informatics and trying to look at this broad view of health information systems, from patient to community to population health. And out of that, a couple of interesting ideas emerged. One had to do with building a network of regional centers of excellence in public health informatics across the world and investing in universities and lead health sciences universities to develop the research, the training, and the service programs that would support health information system development across countries and across the world. We have been working on this and working on it since the meeting was held. In December, there will be a workshop in Nairobi on this very topic, for particularly focused on East Africa, but there will be individuals from throughout Africa and from other centers in academic institutions in other parts of the world. So we are working on that. And the second recommendation had to do with the architecture that I just showed, the Health Metrics Network, a network approach and an idea of foreign architecture. I'm going to quickly just point out that one of the places that is serving internationally as a model for how one might build such academic programs is our colleagues at Cayetano Heredia University. I think many of you know Walter Curioso, and we've had a number of students from Cayetano. They, in about 10 years, went from basically no health information infrastructure for the campus, a very rudimentary library, and a very limited view of academically what informatics is, to a collaboration funded by the Fogarty International Center and the University of Washington and other collaborators, to the point where they now have a very comprehensive research and training and service program. And they just received word from Fogarty that they have been funded to continue that work and build an Andean network of health informatics institutions and training, so across the Andes region. It's quite an amazing story, and it's captured a lot of interest across the world, and it is a model that we are going to be exploring in the workshop in Nairobi, that as well as other models. Mahidan University, where a number of us also work in Bangkok, has developed a very interesting center of excellence in biomedical and public health informatics. They are doing a lot of work on developing surveillance approaches that will work, for instance, on the border with Myanmar, disease collection information that can be used in places that have no connectivity, using handheld devices and other approaches. So this is a very sophisticated center for public health informatics. It's a place that we have worked and will be teaching another course in collaboration with faculty there for people from across Southeast Asia. But again, these two, Cayetano and Mahidan, and our center here at the University of Washington, are building blocks for what we envision as a set of regional centers and academic institutions across the world, where the top level, the C's, are the technical assistants, the universities that have well-developed health informatics programs. But the primary focal point is the universities in countries, in developing regions of the world, where the investment is made in infrastructure and expertise and so forth. And then the satellites, as in the Andean region, are the outlying universities and other collaborators who come to University of Nairobi or Makerere University or university in Cambodia or Vietnam and work there rather than bringing students here or to Europe for training. So the global partners, that's just my plug for the global partners site. I'll show you the web address in a minute. In conclusion, the solutions, I think, to what we call the bio-risk challenges lie in more than just technology. We've got to coordinate efforts across the Global Express. We have to look at integration and interoperability by collecting data once, at whatever encounter level it is, and using it many times, from individual to population. We've got to improve the way we communicate across languages and cultures and time. And most importantly, I think, to really achieve all of this, we have to invest in human capacity development. And I think the training model that says bring all of the students from across the world to the U.S. or to Norway, to pick on Norway, or to England is a bad model and will not scale in the long run. We absolutely have to build that capacity in universities in resource-constrained countries. So there are some selected sites, and unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time for questions, but maybe we have time for a couple. So that's it.
Yeah, we can take questions until people start coming
in. Okay, that's good. And for those of you who have heard me talk before, I always pick on the people in the back row, not the people in the front row. So if you don't ask me questions, I will ask you questions. We have a question from the front row.
Sure. So this is a very nice overview of what you would like to happen in the world. I'm curious what you think for your research, where you focus.
What I have focused on over the years has evolved. And what my research most recently has been about has focused on knowledge management and building open source approaches to allow individuals to organize, or individuals or particularly groups, in our case public health departments, to organize the complex set of information and data and tools to support evidence-based practice in public health. And so I've worked on a tool or a open source software solution called My Public Health, which is being used in a couple of places and which we are looking at as a tool for some of the university settings in other parts of the world that we're working with. But it's really about making information sharing much more effective for building evidence-based decision-making programs. So that's specific, but I spend a lot of my time on airplanes working, I guess as a coach is one of the words I would use, because I think that if you don't have this high-level conversation, all of the sitting in a corner writing code is not going to solve the world's disease problems. The reason we're in the mess we're in is because there isn't enough discussion of the big picture and how should these pieces fit together, in my opinion. Now, I'd be happy to hear a dissenting opinion about that. But good question. Thanks. Yes, question. Okay. You might say who you are, too.
Okay. I'm Johnson, who I happen to be coming from Taiwan before I came here.
Aha! I love Taiwan. I love Taipei, by the way.
And before I came here, I'm an emergency physician working in the National Taiwan University.
Aha!
Yeah. And actually, there's a panic in Taiwan about getting the H1N1.
Yes. In the United States, is that what you're saying? We don't care here?
Yeah, that's not my fear. My fear. I'm not sure it's true. Actually, I don't get a call before I come in here. Although I have to see a patient come into an emergency department just for fever, and they want to make sure they got it. It's my H1N1 flu. Yeah.
Right.
Everywhere I went in Taipei and around Taiwan.
Yeah.
next outbreak of flu might be. So Mark Smolensky and that group is also working on some really interesting ways of figuring out what is going based on things people are already doing.